Well, I'd like to welcome you to a new season of our forum meetings. I think most of you know I'm Gary Gray. I teach in the English department here. Our chapter president, Dr. Art Robertson, is away for the weekend. I guess this is what happens. He just retired, so I guess this is what happens. The lure of grandchildren is, I guess, a little too strong to resist. So he's off seeing grandchildren this weekend, and we hope he has a good time. Stella will lead us in our opening prayer.
Let's bow our heads. Our Father in heaven, we thank you so much for this Sabbath day and for the privilege that we have of gathering together. We ask that your Holy Spirit will be with us, and that as we and the greater church looks at its education for its children, that we may take our lessons from the great teacher, your Son. We pray for our brothers and sisters and their children around the world. In Jesus' name, amen.
Just a note about future meetings. For this fall, October 20th, Richard Coffin will be our speaker. He's a retired editor from First Southern Publishing Association and then Review and Herald Publishing Association. He'll reflect on his many years in Adventist publishing. On November 10, Kurt Vanderwall from Andrews, John Gavin and William Ellis from Washington Adventist University will talk about a survey of faculty from SDA colleges and universities on religious and political issues. And as this will be just a few days after the upcoming election, it should be purely coincidental timing. December 1, Larry Richards, who's I believe a Greek specialist, will talk about manuscript and translation issues related to the Bible. So that's our fall lineup. One addition from Stella Gregg, who has been instrumental in helping to organize the Association of Adventist Women, will have their convention on our campus the weekend of October 6th. And we were able to get them to open a meeting to the public. So that Sabbath afternoon, which is October 6th, which is coming up before our next October meeting, 3:00 in the Newbold Auditorium in Buller Hall. Our friend Larry Garrity will chair a panel discussion on women's ordination issues. So you might want to note that in your calendar. But note the difference in place and time. It will not be here. It will be in Newbold Auditorium in Buller Hall. And it'll be at 3:00, not our usual 3:30. So, our speaker today is Dr. Jerry Thayer. He began his career as a boys' dean at Campion Academy in Colorado. He's worked at a number of universities and schools across the nation. These include Union College, Northeastern Missouri State University, Atlantic Union College, and he's been at, of course, Andrews University for quite a while. Jerry was the first director of assessment at Andrews, and his wife followed him in that position a few years later. They have two adult boys and two twin grandchildren. Jerry received his bachelor's from Union College, a master's from the University of Nebraska, and a PhD in educational measurement and research at the University of Northern Colorado. And I just wish I had a dollar for every time Jerry has helped a graduate student at the master's or doctoral level with their statistics in their research project. Because if I did, I'd be a lot wealthier than I am today. So we welcome Jerry.
Okay, today I'm going to tell you about a research project that I've been working on for the last few years called Cognitive Genesis. Cognitive Genesis fits into a pattern of measuring outcomes of advanced education. I've classified these outcomes into six different areas: two cognitive areas, two affective areas, and two behavior areas, and divide them into spiritual and other. Cognitive is knowledge, knowing something. So what you call it, knowing spiritual things, knowing other things. Affective is values, attitudes. And so you can have values and attitudes about religious things or about other things. Or you can have behavior. How do you behave in spiritual things or in other kinds of things? So what I'd like to do is give you detail on one project, that Cognitive Genesis, which deals with in the red area, one of those six areas. But I'd like to give you a brief overview of what research has been done in the other five areas to sort of put it into perspective. Now, Cognitive Genesis is limited to only measuring that one of the six areas. It's only trying to measure in an Adventist school system from K to 12, how does it do in terms of teaching non-spiritual things, reading, writing, and arithmetic. So it's only measuring one small aspect of what you might expect from an Adventist school. What we did is we tested elementary and secondary grade students, grades 3 to 8, 9 and 11, in all students in all Adventist schools in the North American division. We did this for 4 years, from 2006 to 2009. And since that time, we have added 2 more years of testing from the North American division that is not part of Cognitive Genesis, but we have merged that data with the Cognitive Genesis data. So we have actually 6 years of testing data on every student in every school in these grades in the division. The project director is Alyssa Quito from La Sierra University. She used to be the dean of the school there. I wanted to emphasize this because there are some good things that La Sierra are doing, and in Michigan, I have to emphasize that. Other places, I might not have to do that, but we have to do it in Michigan. The data all comes to my office. It's all been processed in my office, and I've done the majority of the research on the project. The funding has been entirely external. The church has not provided any money for this. It's all been through foundations and individuals that Alyssa Quito has gathered the money for. And up to this point, it's over $1 million in the project, of which Andrews has been very richly blessed with up to close to $180,000 at this point, including $5,000, which came in last week. So it's a continuing, ongoing thing. So we have 4 years of good data that's pretty comprehensive from Cognitive Genesis, and we've been working on the analysis and reporting for the last 5 years. What we did, we try to measure change. How did students change across those years? So we give 2 achievement tests, one to the elementary grades, one to the secondary grades, and an ability test. The IO test of basic skills, most of you have heard of. These are the tests we gave in the elementary grades. And these are probably the most popular standardized achievement and ability tests in the country. In addition to that, we gave surveys. We gave a student survey to every student. We gave a survey to every parent, a survey to every teacher, and a survey to every administrator. And so we have a huge amount of data based on this. And so we try to relate achievement with the ability and the characteristics that we got from these surveys. The data set has close to 100,000 different students that we have data on, about 52,000 different students, because many of them were tested more than 1 year. And our data set has about over 7,000 variables, so it's a huge data set. All conferences participated, although a couple conferences or 3 conferences left out 1 year because of some administrative problems. And so it's about 800 schools each year that we tested. If you count the 2 last years that we've added data, we have now data for about 70,000 students and about 7,400 variables. So it's a huge data set. What we try to do here is we basically look at achievement and compare that to the national norms, and we're controlling for ability somewhat to find out is the achievement that we have due to better students or better teaching. So we try to control for ability. But one thing we found after we had been analyzing the data, we added an arrow here that we did not have in our original model. We have determined that ability is a very nice outcome of our school system. Initially, we were thinking of achievement as being the outcome and ability as being a control. We've noticed that ability is a good outcome, which I'll get to a little bit later. And then we're trying to control or relate variables in these surveys, variables about the student, about their parents, about their teachers, about their school, from the different surveys. What we try to do is to find areas of strength and weakness. You know, what are we good at? What are we not so good at? What can we improve on? And what are the factors that influence achievement? What can students do to raise their achievement? What can homes do? What can schools do? What can teachers do? And we tried to deal with some things that we thought were misconceptions. The fact that how can a school, a one-room school out in the country with no lab, how can they teach science? How can you learn when you don't have much to work with? We wondered, is that true? If you spend an hour a day on Bible, that means there's an hour less you can spend on the other things. Do you then not learn as much on the other subjects? I went to a home and school meeting in Connecticut once, and they said, well, of course we have good achievement. That's because we're so smart. Well, is it because of parents that the students do well, or is it because of the school? And we wanted to deal with small schools, and we wanted to find out whether the gifted students and special needs students do well in our schools. Because sometimes you hear a lot of parents saying, we're not going to send our student to your schools because they have special needs, either because they're below or above average. We wanted to find out, is that true? Many parents assume when they send their kids to an Adventist school that they're doing it for spiritual things. They're more likely to get to heaven if they go to an Adventist school. So the graph here is the more you go to an Adventist school, the more likely you are to go to heaven. Okay. However, you also see, they say, well, but if they go to heaven, they're not going to go to Harvard. Because the more often you get to an Adventist school, the less likely you are to go to Harvard. Well, we wanted to find out, is that true? You know, that's a common thing. You hear it frequently when administrators try to talk their parents into sending their kids to the school. Well, I want to send my kid to a good college, and going to an Adventist school is not going to help that. Well, is that true? Well, we wanted to find out. Okay, so what I've done over the, I did this in a project a few years ago. I reviewed the literature in all six areas, and I found 12 good sets of data, 12 good research studies that have examined what students learn in Adventist schools, and 17 different reports on that, starting back in 1978. I won't go over all of these, but you notice my name's on a lot of these. This has been something I've worked on since 1978. But up until the last few years, we've never done anything on cognitive areas in a large study. There are not a lot of dissertations on this. Three major studies, Valuegenesis 1, Valuegenesis 2, and Roger Dudley did a huge 10-year study that I helped him with. He studied students from about age 16 to 26, every year sent them a survey to find out what's happening to kids once they leave our schools. And so we have a lot of research studies that have been done. So I'd like to sort of talk about these very, very briefly before I get into cognitive genesis. So outcome one, Bible. Do they know their Bible? Well, I did a major study 20 years or so ago and gave students, 20,000 students or so, a test of the Bible. In other areas, that's cognitive genesis. That's area two. Area three is the one that's been the most popular area of the six. That's where the Valuegenesis 1 and 2, and now we have Valuegenesis 3 that have just come out, which I've not examined yet. So a lot of these kind of attitudes, faith, grace, attitude towards beliefs, do you intend to marry an Adventist, be an Adventist, remain in the church? A lot of studies on that. Other attitudes about social concern. What do students in our schools think about social issues and behavioral standards, which are really not spiritual as such? What about their behavior? Do they study the Bible more if they go to our Adventist schools? Do they pray? Do they attend church? Are they more likely to be an Adventist? So their behavior we've studied. And we studied things like non-spiritual issues like health. Are they healthier? Adventist health studies, which have not gotten into this. But social action. How do students socially act when they're in our schools? These 12 studies have tried to do a lot of controlling. They have compared people with all Adventist education with no Adventist education. In other words, they've compared public school kids, public school Adventist kids, and Adventist school Adventist kids. Are they different? The more they're in Adventist school, do they make a difference? They've tried to control for a lot of other factors. So there's a lot of research done on this. Here are some of the outcomes. In terms of knowledge, it's very clear the more likely they go to an Adventist school, the more they know about the Bible. That's quite clear. In terms of science, reading, writing, arithmetic, I'll give you the cognitive genesis results in a minute. In terms of faith, there's a consistent positive correlation between how much you've gone to an Adventist school, K-12, and most of the variables that are Adventist church related. But when you go to more general spiritual things that are not Adventist related, it's a bit inconsistent between public school kids and Adventist kids. And we could spend an hour or two or three on this topic. In terms of environment, in terms of our standards, it's not consistent whether our Adventist kids are more favorable towards our Adventist behavioral standards by going to an Adventist school or not an Adventist school. It's pretty inconsistent on that. The one negative area is on social concern. Kids from public school have a greater social concern than kids that go to an Adventist school. This is the one negative thing we've found. This came out of Roger Dudley's study primarily. In terms of behavior, there's a pretty positive relationship in terms of behavior, whether it's Adventist-related behavior or general Christian behavior. Going to an Adventist school, their behavior is better. Maybe not the attitudes, but at least the behavior. And in terms of diet, we've done some studies on health. The studies that I've been related to are a little bit inconsistent on health, but it has, again, social action. The kids in public school have more social, they do things, social action things, more than kids in Adventist schools. So social concern, social action, are two negative things. Here's a summary of this before we get to cognitive genesis. This summary comes out of Roger Dudley's book, Why Our Teenagers Leave the Church, Personal Stories from a 10-Year Study, which in my view is the most comprehensive and the best research study that's been ever done on these outcomes. And here's what his conclusion is. The information gathered during 10 years is a ringing testimony to the benefits of Adventist education. Some of the differences were great, some were small, but with one exception, which is social concern, they all favored Christian education. That's Roger's conclusion. But as of 2005, of those six outcome areas, one was glaringly missing. There had been no research done in a comprehensive way related to cognitive areas. Are they learning what they need to learn to be successful in the marketplace in those areas? And so that's what cognitive genesis tried to do. We try to deal with the Harvard aspect. Are they really learning things that you can expect them to learn as well as students would learn if they went to a different school, a non-Adventist school? So this was in cognitive genesis. Let me give you the general conclusions first, then I'll give you some details on each of these. The student's achievement is well above average. Their ability is a bit above average. Their achievement is above predicted, and I'd like to stop here for a second. What the company does that publishes these tests, they take the ability, verbal, nonverbal, it's like the SATs, verbal, nonverbal, quantitative. Based on those test scores, they predict what the student might achieve on the achievement test based on their ability. And they predict an actual score for that student. Our students across the division achieve higher in achievement than you would predict based on their ability. And I'll tell you how much in a second. This achievement, this above average achievement or above predicted achievement is true for all subjects, all ability levels, low ability, high ability. For all ethnic groups, for all students of all home backgrounds, it's good whether they're in small schools or large schools, and they do better the longer they are in the schools. So in general, the results are very positive related to what they learn, what they're achieving in our schools, and I'll give you the details on that now. The average achievement, grades 3 through 9 and 11 across the division, is about the 60th percentile, And this has been very consistent from year to year. It varies between 60 and 62, but it's around the 60th percentile. It's above average, above the 50th percentile for all subject areas, math, reading, language arts, social studies, and science. They're all between the 52nd and 60th percentile. Some are not as strong as others, and so we've identified a few weak areas, weak in terms of compared to the other areas, but they're all above average and above what you'd predict based on their ability. One thing in particular that we've done, and this is one that Alyssa Keto at La Sierra is a member of a Sabbath school filled with people from Loma Linda Hospital and Loma Linda University, medical people. And they asked her one Sabbath, of course the kids aren't doing very well in science, are they? You study creation, you don't have good labs, so they're probably not doing too well in science. So she called me on the phone and said, could you work up something on science? So I went in and did that, which I've not done for the other subjects. Well, I did it for math computation, but this is the other main one I did it for. And this is what I found for science. The students are well above average in science. It is either the highest or one of the highest of all the subjects on the test. They're higher than they predict. In every science, in every grade, they're above average. Every sub-area of science, they're above average. And the highest sub-area, and this is what I found doing item analysis, is in scientific inquiry. Thinking scientifically. This is the highest of all the scientific areas, which is very impressive. And you might be interested in this. They've just come out in the last year or so with a new science series, and it's heavily scientific inquiry based. And so this is a strength that we try to have in our science classes. And so the more science, the more years of Adventist schools we have, the higher they do in science. And as they remain in our schools, their science scores go up as opposed to going down. Compared to ability, whereas the average achievement is at the 60th percentile, their average ability is about the 55th percentile. And that looks like a rather small difference. It's actually larger than it appears for reasons I'll mention in a moment. But if you compare their ability to their achievement, they're about a third of a grade level higher than you'd expect for students of comparable ability in the rest of the country. Now, many times you think that, well, maybe Adventist kids are smarter than average. But when they come to the Adventist school, they're actually slightly below average. So these are the students that were the very first time they came to an Adventist school, as far as we could tell. Their average achievement was at the 47th percentile. Their average ability was at the 44th percentile. So our schools are getting very, very average kids. Our kids are not really above average. And if you look at the demographics of it, I think, as I recall, it's about 40% white of our Adventist school system. So a high percent of minority kids in our school system that we're talking about here. But they come out fairly close to average, slightly below in ability, in achievement. But what I did is I did this just for this presentation today. I've not done this before. I took all the 7th and 8th graders, and I compared those who are new to the system. They'd been either 0 to 1 year in an Adventist system, or they'd been all the years in an Adventist system. The kids that were coming in new were about the 53rd percentile, which is comparable to what I just gave you. The kids that spent their whole time in the Adventist school system were at the 73rd percentile in achievement. And they're above prediction. The brand new kids were about 3 points above prediction, which you might attribute that to parents, perhaps. The kids that have been all years in Adventist school were about 6 scores above prediction. Those SS scores are standard scores, which every year they go up about 14 points. So that's about not quite half a year for the kids that have been in Adventist school the whole time. But then in talking to someone in preparation for this talk today, and the person's in the audience, I won't say who it is, prompted me to do the next two slides. Sort of control for home background. And so what I did is I took students that are what I would call a disadvantaged home. How do they do in our schools? And at the bottom here, you'll see how I define a lower or disadvantaged home. Those are homes where the parents have below average income, and neither parent has gone beyond high school. in terms of education. You might call it blue collar. If you want to call it that, that may not be a good term, but I call that a disadvantage to them. These kids who are brand new to the system are about the 40th percentile if they've been in all of our system at the 57th percentile. So you can see a definite advantage of kids that have been in our school. And in both cases, they're above prediction with all Adventist schools, a little bit higher than the other ones. Then I took the kids from the advantage home, the other extreme. And I call it an advantage home is they primarily speak English. Large number of our kids don't have homes where the kids, where they're bilingual or they don't speak English, which are more likely to be in the disadvantaged homes, but there were not enough of them to do this. So this is English only. I did only ones that have two parents, no step parents, no one parent homes, so two parent home, and both parents had at least a college education, college or graduate school. So I call that an advantaged home. Well, they're around the 80th percentile, a little bit higher for those that have been in our school the whole time. And in terms of prediction, about a half a grade level higher than you predict. So at both a disadvantaged home and an Adventist home, or disadvantaged home, you see a nice, either equal to or higher advantage or higher scores for students that have been all years in Adventist school. Another thing we looked at is we followed students throughout the 5 years that we've been gathering data. We have 6 years of data, so it's a five-year follow-up of change. And we noticed that the kids make small changes in achievement each year. About one percentile point. Over 1 year, they went up 1, 3 years, just happens to be one per one. I didn't plan that, but that's just the way it turned out. In ability, you notice it's a huge increase, which is a big surprise to us. We did not anticipate this. We did not try to use ability as an outcome variable initially. In fact, they weren't even gonna use ability. I fussed and I said, I will not join the project unless you do ability, because they had been going a year before I came on board. I said, you gotta have ability to control. But I was not aware it's gonna be an outcome variable. So over 5 years, the kids went up 18 percentile points, the kids who stayed in their Adventist school this long. Now, one thing we found though, and it was a bit disturbing to me. When we told some people about this, they said, well, the reason why they went up so much is there's what's something called a practice effect. And one thing about the achievement test is there's an 80% overlap of items from year to year. And so if you take the same test year after year, you remember the questions from last year and you're more likely to get a higher score. So we've been working with the publishers of this test at the University of Iowa with a graduate student there and the author of the test, Richard Lohman. We've sent our data to Iowa. Iowa's analyzed it, we've analyzed it. And we think that those scores are inflated by about a third, probably, maybe as high as a half of that. So of the 18 points, probably 10 to 12 points is real, and about 6 to 8 points is probably practice effect. So we have moderated that, but this is what the actual scores are. But even if you reduce the practice effect down to, let's say, 10 or 12 points, it's still much, much greater than achievement. My read on that is this. It comes from the book Education. That the work of true education is to train youth to be thinkers, which I call ability, and not mere reflectors of other men's thoughts, which I call achievement. If you think of the Adventist school system, we are much less teaching to the test or teaching the textbook as you do in other school systems. Other school systems have MEEP, they have their scores in the newspaper. They're very, very curriculum dependent, where our schools are much more free to do what they want and teach the kids to think and do what they want, hopefully. And this is my read on it, that this is probably why our students increase more in ability than they do in achievement. Okay, the last few things I'll mention is some differences about types of students. The first one is by ability level. I divided the students into four ability groups, the bottom quartile, the middle 50%, and the top 25% in ability. The students that were in the lowest quartile, but their percentile rank on the ability test was between 1 and 25. They were about two-thirds of the grade level higher than you'd predict for students of the same ability that were in other schools nationally, much, much higher. The middle two quartiles were about a third of a grade level higher than you'd expect, and even the students that supposedly wanted to go to Harvard they were doing about a third grade level higher than you'd expect them to do based on their ability level, compared to students that are in other schools around the country. So across the ability levels, you expect that. You expect a good achievement level. We tested it by ethnic groups. And this was one thing that they told me, when you start analyzing this data, we do not want you to analyze it by union. We don't want you to analyze it by conference. And don't you dare analyze it by ethnic group. Well, I've been doing it the first year, I found that every conference in the division, the student scores were higher than predicted. Every conference. So I told them, not a person told me that I shouldn't, as you can expect. So good news they like, bad news they don't like too much. But this was good news, so they didn't mind. Actually, what I did it for is if we could have found that certain conferences were low, we could have identified those conferences and notified and talked with them, but not publicized it across the division. But when we talked about ethnic groups, we found that every one of the major ethnic groups that we had large enough samples to analyze, if you track the students for 3 years in our school system, every group, the change across those 3 years was larger than you'd expect based on what the norm group was changing over those 3 years, which we're quite happy with this. Currently, we're working with a researcher at Notre Dame University, David Sickink, who's in the sociology department, a colleague of Edwin Hernandez, who put us onto him. And we're working together on a project to deal with specifically with Hispanic kids. And we have a $40,000 budget to do this, and he was up here a couple weeks ago, and we're working on this project together, and this is an ongoing thing that we're doing. By school type, we looked at, basically look at small schools. Are small schools doing as well as large schools? We looked at a lot of different ways. How many teachers are in the school? One teacher school, two teacher schools. How many grades does a teacher teach? Are they teaching 2 grades, 4 grades, 8 grades? What's the range of grades? What's the highest grade they teach and the lowest grade they teach? Is it a wide variety? Is it a heterogeneous class, a homogeneous class? How many students per teacher? Or how many students were in the grade that the student was in? Are we the only student in the grade? And so forth. And we found no matter which of those 5 ways we looked at it, the differences were quite trivial. And whenever we did find differences, they were always in favor of the small school. But they were always real small. They were not really important differences, but they were never in favor of the larger school. When you control for ability, the large schools were higher in achievement, but that's because you have Andrews Academy and, you know, all the hospitals and colleges have big schools around them, so the ability of the students is typically higher than you get across a national average. When you control for ability, very little differences in school types. We did find, however, that if you're the only student in the grade, you don't learn quite as much as if there are 2 or 3 of students in the grade. And that's about the best. 2 or 3 scores about the highest. Beyond that, it doesn't really help. But 1 is probably not the best. And so we've done a lot of stuff on this. The last 3 slides are talking about relating the surveys to the tests. What factors in the home, in the student, in the school relate to a good achievement? And we've developed models. We've developed 4 student models. And what kinds of students score well on the tests? And we did models at different grade levels, and we separated out by dorm students and non-dorm students. And here's what we found. That what the kids do after school makes a big difference. If they do what I call positive things, like reading, religious kinds of things, they do better in school. If they do what I call detracting things, like watching TV, playing on the computer, texting, talking to their friends, playing sports, they don't do as well. The last one is trying to do their best in school, get along with their parents, good friends, spiritual health are also related. Strong effects here, but the kind of student it is makes a big difference in how they're achieving. In terms of the home, we dealt with 4 different kinds of home, actually, I'm sorry, 3 different kind of home models, lower elementary, and then in secondary, we dealt with only non-dorm students, because we figured the dorm students weren't that connected with their parents, and so we didn't deal with that. So a big factor was what kind of a reading environment was in the home. Are there books and magazines in the home, and do the parents read them? Two questions. They're both strongly related to achievement. Some of the highest ones, achievement levels, or highest correlations. Is there communication with the family? Is there involvement in the school? Do the parents, are they involved? Is there discipline in the home? If the parents monitor TV, monitor radio, monitor friends, you have to come home at school on school nights at a certain time. All these discipline questions had strong relationship with achievement. Spiritual homes, harmonious homes, and high expectations also were related. And the last thing, we had some school models. The school models were not quite as successful in finding high correlations as the home and student models, but we did find a few variables, school variables, that were related to this, related to the school climate. Did you get along with your teachers and so forth? Academic climate, support from the parents' constituency. We found that pastor support was a strong predictor. The pastors that support the church, the students do quite a bit better. And a lot of pastors don't support the church. That's not a surprise, I don't suppose. But we found that to be true. And good facilities and materials and equipment, and fewer discipline problems. So what we found is that in terms of the other research, they have sort of demonstrated that the heaven is probably okay. But we dealt with the Harvard, that the Harvard is not a negative. It's at least equal or higher than you'd expect based on a non-Adventist school. So turn the lights back on. I'll be glad to answer any questions or listen to any comments that you might have. Yes.
Could you publish this for the general Adventist
Okay.
Say it again.
Yeah, are you going to publish this?
Yeah.
For
so far, what
general?
We've done, we have two major publications. One in the Journal of Adventist Education, and the latest issue of the Journal of Research on Christian Education, which is an academic journal. We've come out with a major study that has much of this material in that article. We have what we call a bookazine, a 16-page bookazine, that if you got into the La Sierra website, you could get that. One copy was passed out to all the teachers at the latest teachers convention, 6,000 teachers in Nashville. So we've tried to get the word out, but it's coming. But we have tried to do this, right? But also, we have gone out to all the union and educators and teachers for the last 5-6 years. But for the general public, those are the things that we've been doing. It's primarily the general Adventist audience, right? There have been a couple of news articles in the Christian Science Monitor and the Los Angeles Times related to this, but that's about all in the general public literature. Although the Journal of Research on Christian Education is not an Adventist journal. It goes to a lot of other Christian institutions and their libraries and things. So that's referenced in all the indexes and things, it would be.
Jerry, is there a plan to try to get this information into the hands of Adventist parents?
I do not know a concerted effort to do this. I know that Alyssa Keto has met with a lot of parent groups. Other than that, I'm not aware of any. Duane? Good idea. Actually, in terms of publication, we've wanted to do this, and it's just been we've been slower at this than we would have liked, let's put it that way. But I think Spectrum would be a good place for this. Good idea. We hadn't thought of that before.
I mean, just a couple of things. Have you unpacked what's going on? I mean, the National Science Foundation at the college level was amazed how well Andrew students did on a higher achievement given their ability. And, their conclusion was, mentoring and maybe even you guys have shared values. So did you try and unpack what's going on that would make this happen?
Yeah, related to this, we gave a presentation about 3 years ago in Chicago
through Riverside Publishing. They invited us to come and give a presentation to their group. And so we mentioned the results related to small schools. And we said that was sort of a surprise to us that the small schools are doing so well. And some lady in the back raised her hand and said, that shouldn't surprise you. Of course small schools do better. You have small classes, older students help the younger students, and mentoring, and she went right down the line of all the things that why small schools should do better. And that's one thing we are trying to work on, but it's been a rather indirect kind of thing. Now, one thing I could mention, we have done it on the lowest testing area, which is math computation. We set up a task group, a task force on math computation, and we met at the North American Division probably about four, I think it's our second year, 2007. And what I did is identified the top 15 schools and the worst 15 schools, large schools, in math computation. And I gave the list of 30 schools to the North American Division, and they went out and observed all 30 schools. They sent out a person to there, and they brought back about 150 variables in each school, what they're doing in those schools. But I didn't tell them which were the best schools and which are the worst schools. I said, here are 30 schools, go look at them. When they came back, I identified the two groups, and identified here are the ones that have the good math and the bad math. So this is the only thing we've really done on that, and tried to do extensive research on what really is causing the scores to do the way they are.
Jerry, I'm wondering, this is maybe just speculating on your part, but I'm pretty sure that there's an earlier study that looked at kind of the way in which older students, particularly academy students, think about kind of moral maturity questions and kind of thinking about the Bible and things like that. And I'm remembering that they tended to be fairly concrete and fairly... They don't have a lot of nuance and critical thinking around kind of spiritual, biblical kind of things. And I'm just wondering, this seems to indicate with your study that there's a lot of very strong critical thinking skills going on. And I'm just wondering if you can speculate how the challenges that seem to be occurring in the high school level don't seem to be translated at the lower levels. Or are we seeing different kinds of phenomena going on that are unrelated to kind of these cognitive processes?
Well, I'm not aware that these tests really try to get to critical thinking. The scientific inquiry is the closest that we came to that, but really we did not have a scientific inquiry data that I'm aware of on that. And in terms of the study you're referring to, the only one that I'm aware of would be Value Genesis. And I'm not familiar with those results if they did come out of that. And so I really couldn't help you on what you're referring to.
Okay, what kind of abilities are being measured, or how do you measure abilities?
See, I didn't quite catch the question.
How do you measure ability?
Well, there are three questions. Yeah, I've taught tests and measurements for a long, long time, probably longer than we want to talk about. One thing I would do in my tests and measurements class is give them an achievement test and an ability test and ask them to tell which is which. And it's very difficult to look at the tests and tell which is which. The basic, many times on the verbal part of the ability test, it's vocabulary. But you have vocabulary on an ability test and you have vocabulary on an achievement test. The vocabulary on an achievement test are words that are in the textbooks, words that are there that you're being taught. The words on the ability test are words that you should just common knowledge. If you run, just walk on the street, you hear the words. They're just, and if you learn them, that means you have good ability. If you don't learn them, you don't have ability. And the same thing with math, quantitative areas. The questions look like, they look like regular math questions, but they're not curriculum based. So you have verbal questions, quantitative questions, nonverbal questions. The nonverbal questions are the kind that blow me away. They'll take a box and open it up and say, what does this thing look like when it's folded together? Well, I don't have a clue what those are like. So that'd be like a nonverbal ability. And so they ask questions about general things that you would learn not necessarily in school, where a person would normally learn. The kind of question on math would be, they have a lot of sequence. You know, 1, 2, 4, 9, 16, 25, what's the next number? Each one is a squared number. Or you go plus 5 minus 4, plus 6 minus 3, plus, you have sequence of, can they think with numbers and do kinds of things? Like which number is out of place? The ability of numbers. Duane?
Quick question.
Oh, yes.
Okay. Question is twofold. The first question is, I just had a student graduate from the academy, 4 years at the Andrews, okay? And what I found with him is towards the end of his senior year, he did strong in math and sciences, but he almost seemed like he was still average, because by the end of, by graduation time, at least maybe half the class did super well. Like they were, you know, the achievers. And so at that time I felt like, okay, my student is just an average student, even though he did do very well, you know, in certain classes. So how do I, as a parent, how do I get past that frustration? And also, did in your study, did you find the middle, the student that was kind of in between that had the potential to be a high achiever? Does that make sense, sir?
Well, I didn't pick up everything you said, but in terms of how do you determine what a student has learned?
Okay.
You have actually three ways you could do that. The grades they get in the class, how that compares to other students in the class, and but then your standardized achievement tests. What we're doing is the standardized achievement tests, but it could be any of the three. And it's hard, but it's hard to tell sometimes exactly what a student has learned. And one thing, I could mention this, it's, I try to do some data cleaning with the tests. And so what I try to do is throw out the tests or the test scores of students that obviously were not, the scores were not very reliable. So if I found a student that were the 99th percentile on ability and the first percentile on achievement, I figure they were, something was wrong. And we've had a large number of students. If you do the normal curve, a normal curve like this and a big hump at the bottom, a large number of students would have had if you think of an IQ of 50, you know, they missed every question.
Yeah.
Well, we have a large number of students like that. And so I basically threw them out because I figured they weren't, you know, that's something that you really have to try hard to get an IQ of 50, you know, and still be a student in school.
Raise a chance to do you better.
I kept the 51s, but not the 50s. If they got one question right, I kept them in, but not they missed every question. So I tried to do some screening, but related to this, how do you tell when the students are trying? And I could digress just a minute on this. I'm on the assessment committee, and if some of you are on here on that also. Up until last year, we got very mediocre test results for our seniors on general ed kind of tests. Around the 20th percentile, something like that, we were not really happy with this. But the people administering the test said, well, we don't think the kids are trying, the students are trying. The seniors are not trying very hard. They know it doesn't mean anything. So this last year, we tried something new. We had an administrator come to the group and said, please, students, try. The reputation of Andrews depends on you. What do you think happened to the scores? About, what was it, 40, 50 percentile points higher this year than last year. Just unbelievable. It blew us away.
We found a good role for administrators.
So we're hiring them back for next year. So, but this happened to do with tests too. It's hard to know how do you really tell what a student learns, because sometimes they learn much more than appears from their grades or things like that. It's hard to tell. This is why it's nice to have 70,000 students that you're basing your results on, because you can get 5,000 students that aren't trying. But you still have 65,000 that hopefully are trying, and hopefully it's going to get more reliable results.
Thank you very much. I've been intrigued by this for many years, going back 45 years at least. In my Africa days, all the British colonial and post-colonial countries, at the end of high school, they wrote the Cambridge Overseas School Certificate exams. And then Cambridge published the results. So we got the national results, Ghana, Nigeria, Rhodesia, whatever country. So I could compare the Adventist schools with the general national average. And wherever I looked, we were considerably higher. And I was puzzled. I've been puzzled by that for years. Why is that? The missionary teachers, but they weren't all mission teachers. They were locally, many of them were locally trained teachers. Then there was also a practical effect to this. I found that as I got to know the businesses and the factories, and towards the end of the year, if I was there, they'd speak to me, the managers, and they say, have you got a graduate now leaving high school you can recommend to me? They wanted our Seleucia graduates. And I'd say, what is it you want about these? Now, in many cases, the Sabbath was inconvenient for them. They said, well, they seem to do their work very well. All those we've had, they disciplined, they keep their records, they do well. And then they would add on to the thing. They sort of have a model value of truth. How do you account for this broad picture? If you would go across that earlier days where we had those records, what was it about the Adventist schools that we outperformed, generally speaking, the average?
Yeah, my initial impression is I think it's impossible to untangle the cause and effect on this. Where the teacher causes the student causes the teacher causes the parent causes the student. What's the linkage of cause and effect? I don't know. If the results were bad, I would feel much more inclined to invest another $1 million to find out. If it's good, well, I don't feel compelled to find out. But I think it would be for the schools that are not doing so well. It would be helpful.
Does that broad fact that I found there, that surprise you at all?
Well, one thing, when you look at the value Genesis research, they found very clear that good spiritual kids need good homes, need good schools, need good churches. You really need all three working together. And I think this is one thing that probably in an Adventist school you have peers that are supposedly more serious, perhaps. You have teachers that perhaps give more attention. You have parents that probably give more attention, and maybe the combination of the three work.
Question.
Paul. Then Paul.
Question. In solving problems, oftentimes it's very advantageous to think outside the box, the normal way of thinking, in engineering and a lot of things.
Sure.
Is there any chance that you could pick up on Adventist education, whether church doctrine tends to keep people from thinking outside the box?
I'm trying to think of how that would relate to the research that I've been working on. I'm sure it's true. Right now, I'm not exactly sure how to relate to that. I'll have to give it some thought. Maybe I'll. Sometimes you're riding by my house, I can stop you and wait.
Oh, were your findings very different from your assumptions prior to your study?
Well, see, I started doing this in 1978. And so in my view, this was the Atlantic Union when I was teaching at AUC. And we got the exact same results in 1978, but only in one union. And it's basically non-publishable if it's so it's a local thing. So it was not a surprise to me. And we had done schools. Steve Pollack did a dissertation on the same topic in terms of ability, ITBS and ability. He found the same thing in his dissertation. But here again, that was just in the North Pacific Union. It was very local, very small sample sizes. I did a study for the Southern New England Conference over 10 years. But here again, it's a very small one. So I think it was not a surprise to me, but it was to a lot of the people. But a lot of it was anecdotal. They sort of believed this. Well, they've been getting these results for 20 years for their own schools, their own conferences. They never pooled them together. And they never analyzed it as I've been analyzing it with all the different nuances. They just had the overall results. They didn't get much beyond that.
I think, my first 8 years of education, having a system, I was my first 2 years, I was in grades 1 through 4. And, you know, you're absolutely right about, you know, in first grade, I learned the second grade. In the second grade, I reviewed the first grade. And by the second grade, I was tutoring first graders and third graders, and the third graders don't speak to me to this day. But there really isn't that advantage. And I also think, and this is speculative, but the mentoring that goes on, we share similar values, that Protestant work ethic. We don't show up hungover on Monday as often. And you know, we mentor kids. You know, Dr. Herb Helm and I just heard from a student that we spent a lot of time mentoring here. That student's achievement test scores, their SATs, and they came here, were actually just below 50%. But that student has won 3 major research prizes and is an undergraduate and 2 in graduate school. You would have not have predicted it. Yeah. So I think it's the mentoring, the shared value system. We really pay attention. We really care. You know, we don't go home and, forget it, you're out of here. We really do try and work with the kids, and I think that's what you're measuring is, in some ways, you know, that kind of commitment, that mentoring, that ongoing concern, that really makes a difference to take that below average student and turn them into above average achiever.
One thing we tried to do is, you notice I did not have any teacher models up here. We tried to identify teacher variables, and we could not find any teacher variables that correlated with achievement, which to me suggests that there's nothing specific that our teachers are doing that you can put your finger on. This is why they're doing better. It's sort of a general, broad kind of thing. Nothing. It's not because they're using this method or that method, or they're more educated or less educated, or they do this or they do this. Those factors did not seem to have much to do with education. The certified teachers and non-certified teachers, the experienced ones and non-experienced ones, pretty much a wash. So we tried to identify teacher characteristics. And I spent, I wouldn't say hundreds of hours, but lots of hours, and I couldn't find anything. Which means it's a consistent pattern across everything. There's nothing you can put your finger on.
Subcultural.
Yeah. It's nothing you learn in the methods course.
Yeah.
What we found is 2 things. If you love your students, and there's one other one, you're interested in growing professionally. Those are the 2 factors we found. If you love your students and you want to grow professionally, which you don't learn that in the methods course.
The
teacher
said, "I hate my students."
Can I ask about money? Sorry to soil the Sabbath hours with this terrible topic, but can I ask about money? In the non-Adventist educational debate, there seems to be a big thing about money. A discussion that more money helps. Others argue, no, more money doesn't help. I have a close friend that was a elementary school principal in the state of Connecticut, and they paid her really good money. And the state of Connecticut has a lot of money. And they operate on the assumption that if we want good teachers, we have to pay them. What's your reaction to the whole business of money? Because it also translates over into the Adventist system. I mean, my friend Dave Waller, should we raise his salary with these results? Or we're getting such good results, maybe we should lower his salary. How does that? What's your response to money and these results?
I have 3 reactions to that. First of all, I do think that getting better qualified teachers will result in better learning, students with better learning. Now, whether raising the salaries of teachers will get better teachers, I'm not sure. It may or may not, but that's a different issue. But when in my analysis, I found that schools that had better equipment, which is money related, better facilities, which is money related, do better. But we've had a dissertation on that from La Sierra. The vice president of finance at PUC did his dissertation with cognitive genesis data. And what he studied is, does the amount of money per student you spend in the school correlate with achievement? If you spend $5,000 per student or $15,000 per student, how does that relate to learning? He found no correlation. No relationship. And I've read the dissertation. At first, I was suspicious because I was not on the committee. We've had a lot of La Sierra dissertations, and I've been on all the committees except this one. I was not on this one. I've been on the other ones, but not this one. But I read it, and I think his methodology is sound. And I was, but I'm not sure what the answer to that, because it's inconsistent with what I found. So I'm not sure. Perhaps it's what you're spending the money for. Maybe they're spending money for teachers, not for equipment. Or playground, I don't know. But at least it's inconsistent on finances right now, for what I can tell.
Could it be that our whole church system, where our little children go to Sabbath school and learn about foreign countries, I'm sure this doesn't happen throughout the world, except for church-associated education, where they are taught different mission fields, all about the certain countries in Africa and so forth. We are exposed to that from the time we're little. And I think that does definitely have an input in our surrounding education and the health field that we stress so much. I think all those things have play a part in the Adventist doing as well as our doing.
A lot of the presentations that I give, Alyssa Keto and I give them together. And I always prepare her presentations, and then she gives them. And then I give mine, and she'll give hers. And I always have this Ellen White slide on mine where it says, thinkers and not mere reflection of other men's thoughts. But whenever I finish that slide, she always stands up and says, well, I have another point of view. She says, I think it's the great controversy theme, the fact that we have a worldview which integrates all of our subject matters into one thing, and it allows us to have a perspective on learning that's different than people in public schools, which I sort of relates to what you're talking about. In terms of missions, you have a global view. You've probably heard about global things when you hear in history classes and different places. And with science, you connect that with health. It's sort of the holistic viewpoint of learning, our harmonious development of the different things. So I think that's part of the picture.
Could you talk more about the social concern and social action that they lower, they had a low score? And is that against the philosophy that we have, that we see all the countries and our social concern is so low?
Yeah. You know, I've taught in an Adventist school for 40 years, and to me that's not a surprise at all. We're very insular. We don't reach out. We talk to each other. We deal with each other, and we're not as much concerned as a church than I think other people would be likely.
We believe it can be the second coming takes care. We don't think we can improve humanity.
It's not a surprise to me. We try to work on it. You know, Andrews has a service class. We require it. It wasn't required. How long has it been? 10 years, maybe 15.
Yeah, something like that.
But we went for 100 years without it. And so I think Andrews has gotten on the right track. And I know, at least in the Michigan Conference, we've had Bible Labs, which is sort of the same idea of getting out and doing things. But it's, I think it's probably more artificial with Adventist in the Adventist system than it would be probably in the community.
But in my upbringing, there's a certain aspect that seems to me Adventists feel if we get too involved with other people, we'll get contaminated. Therefore, we pull away from that.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that's historical Adventism, I think, is that. Yeah.
Okay. Let's thank Jerry for his presentation.